You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, HER2 Alterations in Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer, Biology, Burden, and Clinical Impact. Given all the exciting data on new HER2-directed therapies, an understanding of HER2 pathobiology in patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer is needed to improve the effective use of targeted therapies. I'm Dr. Eric Singhi, I'm a thoracic medical oncologist, and I am pleased to be joined by my colleague, Dr. Bruna Pellini, who is the Chief of Thoracic Medical Oncology at Baptist Health Herbert Wertheim Cancer Institute. Dr. Pellini, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course, excited to have you and excited to have this update. So today, we're going to be discussing the distinct HER2 alterations identified in patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer and their associated clinical characteristics. So let's get right into it, okay?
Yes.
So let's chat about first the importance of biomarker identification in non-small cell lung cancer, specifically HER2. Bruna, I want to set the stage a little bit. So as you know, and I want our viewers and our listeners to hear about this, biomarker testing has fundamentally transformed non-small cell lung cancer, initially from the single disease where we treated all patients with a one-size-fits-all approach, now into this collection of molecularly defined diseases, each with its own very precise, very targeted treatment strategy. And Bruna, right, that's redefined our outcomes for patients. What do you think?
Yes, absolutely. This has opened the door to so many therapeutic opportunities for our patients. I think if we look at the outcomes for stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer, even 10 years ago, it doesn't even look close to what it does now. And it's such an exciting time to be a thoracic medical oncologist. I bet in the 90s was not as fun as it is now for us.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, in putting some numbers on this, right? Like probably over a decade ago, 5-year overall survival rates for metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, less than 5%. And now we're hearing numbers like 30% in PD-L1 high tumors, even upwards of 60, 70% in, for example, ALK positive tumors. And so I think, you know, all these changes are driven entirely by biomarker-directed therapy, entirely by science, entirely by clinical trials. And so I'm so excited to unpack this space with you.
I know, I agree. I'm excited too.
Let's start with the guidelines, Bruna. What does NCCN, National Comprehensive Cancer Network, what does it tell us about biomarker testing? How do we do it?
So the NCCN guidelines are very clear in the sense that anyone with a non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer should be tested with a comprehensive molecular panel. But, and I think you share the same opinion, I believe the squamous histology should also be tested. There are certain genetic alterations that we may not have targeted therapy now, but they do influence our decisions regarding drug combinations. I test for everyone, and next generation sequencing is the choice of testing.
And you're doing multi-gene panel testing, is that right?
Yes. So in my institution, we have a partnership with Caris. So all of our tissue is sent out to Caris for patients with early stage and advanced stage non-small cell lung cancer. So that's comprehensive molecular testing. So we're not doing single gene testing here.
And let's hone in on HER2 mutations or ERBB2 mutations. Bruna, talk us through that. Is that a standard component of multi-gene panel testing?
Absolutely. HER2 mutations is in all these panels, including liquid biopsy panels as well. Now we have therapies available in the first line setting, so that impacts our decisions when we see patients first that haven't been treated before. Because historically, we know we exhaust tissue if we try to do individual gene testing for every single oncogene. We should try to stay away from this practice if we have the environment that has the resources for that, which in the US we do because this is reimbursed, and that should be the standard across cancer centers in the US to do a comprehensive genomic testing that includes a multi-gene panel.
Yeah, I think this is really helpful. And so far we've emphasized multi-gene panel testing, comprehensive testing, NGS for patients with advanced metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, arguably even earlier stages of disease, right? Topic for another day, but today we're going to focus on advanced metastatic disease. Let's shift a little bit more to learning about HER2 signaling pathways in non-small cell lung cancer. How do they cause pathogenesis? Talk us through, maybe Bruna, the ERBB receptor family, a little bit of the nomenclature here.
Yeah, so the HER2 family they are very promiscuous in the sense that they bind to siblings, and doesn't have to be a HER2, it can be a HER3, and then they activate everything downstream. And that's why it's so complicated, because this, you know, proteins, they sit on the surface of the cell and the gene is activating all these downstream pathways. So they don't need the HER2 to bind to a HER2. It can be a HER3 and a HER2, and that will activate everything downstream. So I think what we know is that before we had therapies targeting this specific genomic alteration, these patients were known to have worse outcomes with the therapies that we have. So for instance, if we look at patients without HER2 mutations that received chemotherapy and immunotherapy in the first line setting, maybe their median PFS was 8 months, 9 months, 10 months if the PD-1 is high in some instances. But when we look at these patients with HER2 mutations that got the same therapy, their median PFS was around 5 months, 6 months. So almost half of the time, which means that the disease wasn't well controlled with the available therapies.
I think that's a really important point, right? That we're trying to further develop our therapies for patients, improve those outcomes. And it really relies on understanding the biology. So I like how you explained it. You said it's very unique. Unlike others, HER2 is unique in the fact that it doesn't have a known ligand, right? It doesn't wait to be turned on. And it's able to have this dimerization partner, you know, for the rest of the family of the ERBB2, right? And so I think that's really important. And it makes it this very potent signal and amplifier within the network, turns on downstream pathways, and that's how you get that oncogenesis. So when we talk about finding a HER2 alteration in non-small cell lung cancer, it can sometimes mean more than one thing, right, Bruna? You know, we have a few different ways of defining HER2 altered non-small cell lung cancer: mutations, amplification, overexpression. Can you talk us through those three types of HER2 alterations?
Yes, absolutely. So mutations, obviously, this is the most common genetic alteration that we are used to seeing in our clinic. It could be a point mutation, it could be a insertion, and so on. And that is the alteration that we have drugs approved in the first line setting. Now we have zongertinib for HER2 mutations in the first line setting that is approved. Now you have the ERBB2 amplification. So the gene is amplified, and it may vary how many copies of the gene are amplified. And we don't yet know what the meaning of this is. How many copies do you need to call it really highly amplified or moderately amplified, and how that will impact the response to future therapies? There's nothing yet as of 2026 approved for ERBB2 gene amplification. So amplification is different than mutation. Mutation, we have drugs approved. We also have savobertinib approved. We have T-DXd approved for HER2 mutations in the second line setting. Now, the HER2 overexpression is really measuring the protein expression in the surface of the cell. A patient may have a mutation and overexpression, or may just have a mutation, no overexpression, or may just have the overexpression without the mutation. Those things are not 100% concordant. And for HER2 overexpression, which is 3+, measured by gastric IHC, HER2 IHC, we have a drug that is T-DXd, trastuzumab deruxtecan, that is approved in the second line setting and beyond for these patients. So again, different alterations, different drugs available, sometimes they overlap. So we have to be cautious not to get confused.
Yeah, I really love how you explain that. When I'm thinking with patients and trainees, like, how do I explain it? I say that in lung cancer, HER2 is not just one target. It can be three different biological stories. And I like how you stressed, one, we can look for them in different ways, right? They can really require different types of testing. And second, they can have different therapeutic strategies or implications. And so really getting the whole picture of the story, all three potentially different biological stories, can be really important for patients. I'm going to add another layer of complexity, Bruna, because we continue to learn from our colleagues in breast medical oncology. They have heard about the HER2 story way before we did. What are some of the differences between what they're doing in breast cancer versus what we're doing in non-small cell lung cancer? What's the distinction?
I think for many years, we tried to use therapies that worked in HER2 mutant breast cancer and HER2 overexpressed, and they just didn't work for lung cancer. And I think a clear example is T-DM1, you could use in lung cancer, but we don't see the responses that we see in breast cancer. Another example is T-DXd works in ultra-low HER2-expressed breast tumors. We don't see this activity in lung cancer, right? And more importantly, when we're just talking about the antibodies without the drug conjugated, so not ADC, it's just antibodies like trastuzumab, period, pertuzumab, that works for breast cancer beautifully, but it doesn't work for lung cancer. So I think understanding that these diseases are completely different, how these alterations in protein overexpressions work is very different. You cannot interchange therapies. You really need studies in that disease group to understand if the drug works or not.
Yeah, I like that. So we can't directly translate our breast colleagues' findings into the non-small cell lung cancer world. And you know, Bruno, when I've looked back and I've tried to learn from some of my breast colleagues, what I've learned is that in breast cancer, HER2 amplification and protein overexpression are typically very tightly correlated. They actually largely overlap. But in non-small cell lung cancer, like you highlighted earlier, that's not always the case, right? And so I think the actual fundamental biology and understanding what these alterations mean for each specific histology is quite different. But I'm grateful that we have our breast colleagues who have kind of paved the way to teach us about drug toxicities, drug management, what do we need to be doing, especially with antibody drug conjugates like trastuzumab, deruxtecan, right? So I think that's nice to have that information.
And another thing is that for breast cancer, there is a HER2 immune histochemistry that is optimized for breast cancer. First of all, we don't have one just for lung, which is an opportunity. Second, that we are using the gastric and gastroesophageal HER2 IHC. And third, there are some discordances depending which scoring you use, even though the antibody is the same, because the way expression is measured for the breast cancer, it requires the entire cell to have the expression. For the gastric and esophageal cancer, it's just partial membrane staining. So there are these nuances. And if you use the incorrect immunohistochemistry, you may be preventing your patient from getting a therapy because the scoring may not be concordant. So choosing the right test is so important because you may be missing an opportunity for a therapy for your patient.
So really diving into the details and making sure you understand the test results, how was it tested, and what does that actually mean for the patient and their family that you're meeting in clinic. So thanks for sharing that important point. I completely agree. All right, so now we're going to get into a little bit more of the specifics for each of these HER2 alterations and talk through the patient population, the clinical characteristics. Let's start first with HER2 mutations. Bruna, how common are they and what's the typical patient profile look like?
Yeah, so for HER2 mutations, we see a lot of young patients, mostly females. Never smokers is very common as well. And a lot of these patients end up having brain metastases, even at the time of diagnosis. So one very important take-home point for me is that although the guidelines don't clearly state that we should be monitoring our patient's brain for the development of brain metastases in this patient population, I do. Because I know the risk is very high that these patients may have brain metastases or develop them over the course of their treatment.
Many of these patients, unfortunately, will present with de novo brain metastases or develop a brain metastasis during their cancer treatment journey. So I appreciate that sentiment. And I do the same thing for my patients. You know, I treat a lot of patients that we define as young onset lung cancer under the age of 50. And so that's that group that I'm thinking about. But importantly, if you don't look or you don't check, you won't know if a patient has a HER2 mutation. And so I myself also have patients in their 80s and they're male, and they even maybe have a light former smoking history. So make sure we're checking all patients. I think that really emphasizes the importance of biomarker testing.
Following up on this point that you made, although we see an enrichment of this genomic alteration in young patients that have never smoked, that doesn't mean that patients that have smoked or had a light smoking history cannot have that, or older patients. So again, it's just our pretest probability of finding this is higher in that patient demographic, but it doesn't exclude it from happening in a different patient demographic.
Absolutely. So now let's talk about HER2 amplification. There's de novo, there can also be acquired. Maybe talk us through that difference briefly, and then also a little bit about the patient characteristics.
So the patients that present with HER2 mutations, I think we dove into this. They're usually the ones that have never smoked and the cancer is being driven by this alteration. Sometimes when we give specific therapies, patients may develop or acquire a HER2 alteration. And I'd say even more commonly, we'll see HER2 overexpression that could happen after certain targeted therapies as a mechanism of resistance. So I think to me, I have seen in more instances the development of a HER2 overexpression after certain targeted therapies, as opposed to necessarily HER2 mutation. But again, it can also happen in the setting of another genomic alteration after a targeted therapy.
Yeah, exactly. And so I've also seen it myself. So HER2 amplification for me is more common for acquired mechanism of resistance. For example, if a patient's on an EGFR TKI, tyrosine kinase inhibitor, can happen in even 10% of cases, right? So I'm looking for that. There are some emerging drug strategies on kind of how to approach that. Of course, clinical trials should be considered as well too. So that's the HER2 amplification space. And then last but not least, you kind of talked us through this already, but HER2 overexpression, you said IHC3+, correct?
Yes, correct.
So talk us through that. Is there any particular demographic association, any other clinical characteristics?
Yes. So I think it's very important for our patients with KRAS mutant lung cancer for us to look for that. I'm biased because we conducted a study in my previous institution where we did see what it seems to be a signal, because it's a small study, a single institution. So it's thought provoking or hypothesis generating that maybe KRAS mutant lung cancer has higher rates of HER2 overexpression. And a colleague actually did an analysis in the KRAS database, thousands of cases, and they also find similar findings that KRAS seems to have higher rates of HER2 overexpression. I think EGFR mutant lung cancer that you alluded to, amplifications happen and overexpression could happen, especially after targeted therapy. For the other oncogene-driven tumors, I don't think we have enough data, but anecdotally, I have seen HER2 overexpression in ROS1 fusion-positive non-small cell lung cancer post-targeted therapy. So honestly, based off of this data that we have from two studies in KRAS, we have some data in EGFR for amplification, some for overexpression. I think for every single patient that we give targeted therapy, I would recheck if I haven't had a baseline to see if it potentially changed. Maybe a 2+ went to a 3+.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, right? How can we find maybe potentially more treatment options for our patient if they unfortunately experience disease progression on their first, second line of therapy, right? So I think it's a great idea. Well, I think we have just a little bit of time left. I think my last question for you today is talking a little bit more about the importance of biomarker testing so we can figure out sequencing for HER2-directed therapies, right? You kind of alluded to this already, that sometimes you're rechecking, you're retesting at time of progression. Why is testing so important in the first place, and then subsequent lines of therapy planning? Talk us through that.
A lot of us use liquid biopsies, but liquid biopsies are imperfect. You may miss a genomic alteration depending on the gene that you are looking for the alteration, anywhere from 5% to 30%. So it's not 100% concordance with tissue. I believe, in my opinion, you have to have both testing done in parallel, as long as you have the resources to do that. But my point is, I wouldn't completely trust a liquid biopsy, especially if it didn't show any genomic alteration, without having the tissue that is still gold standard. Because I have seen patients of mine that came for a second opinion that had a liquid biopsy that didn't show the HER2 exon 20 insertion. And then when they progressed on other systemic therapy, and I actually collected the cells from the pleural effusion and sent for sequencing, we could find the alteration. And again, they missed an opportunity to be treated the best way possible. And I will say this, and I know it's a little controversial, I do not give immunotherapy, and I hadn't given in the past for these patients. I don't think it's a hot tumor microenvironment. So this patient in question had received a single agent immunotherapy because the PD-L1 was super high. Of course, the patient's tumor didn't respond, and he had a HER2 exon 20 insertion. So at that time, it was a few years ago, we didn't have the targeted therapies that we have now. Zongertinib, savolitinib didn't exist. But I did have trastuzumab deruxtecan. So I was able to treat this patient with that for over a year. It was almost a year and a half. So excellent response. So again, testing comprehensively from the get-go, not trusting your liquid biopsy. If it doesn't show something, doesn't mean it's not there. It may not be shedding enough DNA at the time of the blood collection. I'd say in this situation, if I hadn't looked for it, I would have missed the opportunity to give my patient a drug that is targeting the genomic alteration. So you should retest it. It hasn't been tested initially. And I think we all agree that if you give your patient targeted therapy, you should retest it to know what kind of mechanism of resistance develops. Sometimes it's not going to be genomically driven, so we're not going to find anything that we can target, but we must test.
Yeah, thanks for sharing those important clinical pearls. And I think it's so important to be talking about this, right? Especially with colleagues that are very well immersed in this space, learning about all the updates and how do we translate those updates, not only from academic centers, but going to clinical practice, which is really in the community where the majority of our patients are treated. So thank you so much, Dr. Pollini. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank you for, you know, sharing your insights, your experience with us regarding the importance of differentiating between all these different types of HER2 alterations, the associated disease burden, and that clinical impact in these distinct patient populations. We hope you will listen to the second episode of this series. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And this is a non-promotional educational disease state awareness initiative supported by an independent educational grant from Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Inc. Thank you.